I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
So John, I'm prepping to come downstairs to start a recording, and I have my little area down here, and I've got one table that has my little box, I think that I've shown you before, the mm-hmm. you know, the little recording box where I have some books stacked up, and then I have my microphone on top of the books, and then I have the box around the microphone. And then I have another little table to my right, and that's where I put my laptop, and I have that set up a certain way so that my laptop is elevated because it gets hot as we're recording. You know, I want the airflow to go under it.
Sure.
And I come down here and my little table's gone. My whole setup for the laptop is gone. And I'm like, what the hell? My brother came down in the basement and just took that table. And I'm like, I go to him. I'm like, where's my little table? He's like, what little table? I said, the little table that I use to record. You don't use that little table. I said, yeah, I do. I have my laptop. No, you don't use that. I do use that. He's like, it's in that little alcove thing. I said, yeah, where I record. I had it set up, you know, a specific way with, I said, you didn't notice that I had my little laptop stand and all that kind of stuff to, you know, to keep it elevated and everything. You don't use that table. Yes, I do. He's like, well, fuck. I didn't think anybody used that table. I'm like, no, I do. And so he gives me the table back.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, really?
Yeah. Why do people like deny what is actually going on? It's like, why
it
would
so
I lie here?
It was so specifically placed. Like, it's not like it's like the whole thing is very specifically laid out. No, you don't use that table.
Yeah.
I promise you I do.
Yeah.
So I had to spend an extra 5 or 10 minutes like readjusting everything and getting everything back into place this morning. It was hilarious.
I gotcha. Yeah. It's I was, as you were telling that story, I was thinking about, set like recording setups. Cause I don't really record music anymore, but I have like that kind of, you know, recording box, like the audio interface and all of that. And I've been thinking a little bit about it. Cause I've mentioned, like, I've been going, there's this nice music community here. And so I find myself talking to a lot of musicians these days and a lot of guitar players specifically. And as you know, being a guitar player yourself, there are some guitar players that are, I'd say most guitar players probably, and most musicians in general, but specifically guitar players, love talking about gear. Like gear. And you could just talk about amps and pedals and setups and everything. And I certainly used a lot of gear at one point. I did all that looping stuff and everything.
Sure. Yeah.
And when I see some gear and we see what some guys set up, I am like, never again. I will never. That is one of the reasons why I switched to bass, because I just thought, like, you know what? With bass, if you have a good instrument and a good amp or a direct box, you have a cord, you have your instrument, and you plug in and you are done. And especially that I use that electric upright now, I just go from a direct box right into the PA. So even though my instrument is a pretty big instrument and it's a little unwieldy to carry the instrument, once I set it up, it's literally plugging two things in. Sure. And you're done. Yeah. And you know, besides the lugging the stuff and the setting it all up and all of that pain, a lot of my desire to move away from all that other stuff is, it's, for me, it can be distracting and anxiety provoking, because if you have 15 pedals and rack gear and whatever else, you know, you're in the middle of play and now all of a sudden you hear a hum. You're like, oh, where's that coming from? It could be any 20 of these pedals or any of these chords. This could be a bad chord. And so to me, it's like, if you have a problem when you're just plugged your instrument into an amp, it's like, well, it's this chord, because that's all it could be. So I'll just swap.
You know, that's really funny, because I dipped my toe into electric,
mm-hmm.
but I never really took the plunge necessarily.
Right.
So that it's really funny. Even to this day, I still prefer an acoustic guitar.
There is something so, and don't get me wrong, I love electric guitar playing. I loved playing an electric guitar.
I do too.
I love the pedals. I love the, like, I really enjoy all of that. And I get, because I did it. I was one of those guys that was super into the gear and everything. It's just, there is something so liberating about just having a good instrument and minimal gear, like just whatever you can. Now, obviously, if you're playing an acoustic and you don't need to amplify it, then there is no gear. The gear is the strings and a pick. And that is a lovely thing. And again, one of the reasons why I like playing the upright, because there's no gear. There is a direct box and your sound. So when you can just concentrate on making a good sound with your hands and making good music and musical choices, like, I know that's a little artsy fartsy, but that's what I want to put my, you know, my, I want to focus my brain on making a good sound and making good mental choices. Not like, ooh, if I step on the overdrive pedal here and then add a little bit of delay and a wah pedal, like, that's fine. That's part of making music. Like, your sound is part of it. And specifically when you're playing an electric guitar, that is part of playing it, is learning how to get a good sound. And that often does entail pedals and rack and settings on your amp. That's part of it. But it's nice to not have to deal with that, for sure.
Well, and it's like, you know, when I bought the Gibson hollow body, I didn't have an amp. Mm-hmm. And so I needed an amp, and I went out and bought that Strawberry, which is really good for acoustic guitars as well. Like, I wanted something that would be good for an acoustic guitar. And the funny thing is, when I bought that, I was living in a very small apartment building. And I specifically kept asking the guy at Guitar Center, like, I want an amp that I can plug a guitar into, but also plug in headphones so I'm not bothering everybody else in the building. And he said, oh, you could totally do that with this one. And he lied. You know, you can plug headphones into it, but sound still comes out of the speakers.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Right. So that kind of killed it for me, and I didn't really use that very often. My brother, to this day, you know, uses that amp all the time. He loves that amp. He loves electric, he loves amps, and he will also plug the acoustics into amplifiers and play the acoustics in the amplifiers, because he just loves to have that electric, that, and he loves to do all the stuff that you're talking about. His dad sent him that Fender Mustang 4 that I was talking to you about. I don't even know if you remember that. You and I were texting back and forth a little bit about that. Mm-hmm. That is a really nice amp, and it does have a really good sound, and it's got the pedal that came with it, you know, with all the little buttons and stuff. And even that, like, I'm just not that interested.
Let me ask you,
I don't want to be that loud.
So you have, this is, for people who don't like this stuff, sorry, but I know there are some, gearhead people.
Yeah. This is for me, John, and Stace. Keep going.
Stace, hope you're enjoying this episode. Everyone else is turning this off at this point.
Yeah.
When you have, I know you have Mac computers and you have an audio interface. Mm-hmm. There are, And I'm pretty sure you can, with your audio interface, you can plug a quarter inch into it, right? You can technically. So I don't know if you've ever experimented with that, but I know now I have Logic Pro, but there is I can't think of the name of it right now. It used to come with Logic. Now it's a separate program, but it's sort of a live version of Logic, meaning instead of recording, it just has all of the, like synthesizer plugins and piano plugins, but it also has all the guitar amp stuff that you can use as if you were going to play live. So if you were somebody that, you know, was going to play a gig and you brought your laptop and an audio interface and everything, then you can just use your laptop as your amp sounds. So that's something, if you ever wanted to mess around with electric guitar sounds, that is worth looking into, because I want to say that, like, Logic is like a $200 program, but the other one, and I don't know why it's escaping me now. I'll have to look it up later. I feel like that's maybe like a $30 to $50 program, but you get all the amp models and like all the pedal board models. So it just models like every classic Marshall and Fender amp and everything in between. And it has whole pedal boards where there's a visual representation up on your screen, and you can like adjust the knobs like on your screen, and it's really fun. And I think with that program that I'm thinking of, I think there's even like a looping plugin too within it. So if you like wanted to sort of like record yourself like a blues progression or what have you, then you can just go to your amp models and have your blues progression playing, and then you can just solo with the amp. So it's worth looking into. It's not very much, and considering you have the hardware already, it's worth just messing around with one day. You would enjoy, like, you know, plugging your guitar into
sure.
into all those like classic amps. It's fun stuff. So
yeah, I have. I'll say that the stuff that I have is old.
Mm-hmm.
The little box that I have that you can plug mics and guitars and different things into, and then plug that into your laptop. Ooh, I want to say that's like 12, 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't updated any of that stuff, you know, because it just hasn't been a focus for me to mess yeah. with music that way.
Yeah, we're you know, and talking about amps, one of my guitar player friends, we were at this one bar this week, and there was a Phish cover band playing, and they're very good. And the guitar player was excellent in it. And we were talking about Trey Anastasio, who is the guitar player in Phish, and we were talking about his amp and everything. And he's like, well, cause I asked him, like, well, what did that guy use? And he's like, well, you know, at one point he was using the Mesa Boogies, and then he went through like a Fender Twin phase. And I said to my friend, I'm like, you know, isn't it funny? And I know this is sort of this is not an original thought on my part, but I'm like, isn't it funny when you sort of read the histories of these guitar players' setups and how they'll use wildly different amps in different eras of their playing and their recorded output. And yet they still kind of sound the same. like, think about Clapton. You know, I mean, Clapton, you can kind of tell a difference in his sound from era to era, but he used wildly different gear. Because at mm-hmm. some points, like in the Cream days, he used like a Gibson SG or a Les Paul through a Marshall. And then he obviously, I think he's most well known for like his Strat through like a Fender amp thing, which is a totally different thing, but he still sounds like him. So the gear is important, but I always kind of feel like, you know, players get a good sound, and a lot of it, I know I hate it because it's like one of these weird cliches that I sort of hate, but like the sound is in your hands, and it's kind of true, but it's, you know, I think the sound's in your hands, but it's also in your head, and it's you make that sound with your hands, but you also tweak your gear until you get it to sound the way you want, or as close to like the sound you have in your head. Cause you can put the same player on the exact same setup and they will sound differently. Sure. And a lot of that has to do with tweaks and things like that.
And this dovetails very nicely into what you're talking about. There's two things. One, you know, people, we've watched a lot of documentaries, you and I, mm-hmm. and a lot of them about music. And I just remember someone saying, you always know that it's B.B. King.
Mm. Yeah.
You always know that it's B.B. King. Even if he's not singing, even if he's not necessarily credited, when he starts playing guitar, you know that that's B.B. King because he has a very distinctive sound that he gets mm-hmm. out of that guitar. You just know it. It's very similar with what you're talking about with Eric Clapton. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I posted recently on Facebook about was Echo in the Canyon.
That is in my queue, and I've been wanting to get to it too, because I have been going through a bunch of music docs. So I haven't watched it yet, but I will soon, I'm sure.
I think it's one of the last interviews with Tom Petty.
Oh, okay.
And he and Jacob Dylan are in a music store, and they're looking at the, this is how they pronounce it very specifically, the Rickenbacker mm-hmm. 12 string.
Okay.
Because that was the sound of Laurel Canyon.
Yes.
That mm-hmm. was the guitar that changed and kind of melded folk and rock. Because it was mm-hmm. an electric guitar, but it was a 12 string, and folk music was being played on that guitar as rock. And that's, you know, the Birds were using that, and, mm-hmm. and different bands were using that. And it has a very distinctive sound. And, you know, it's exactly what you're talking about. It's that sound, right? And when you hear it, you go, oh, I know this.
Right. I know this. For people who, you know, if you're listening to our conversation here, if the best example I can think of, although I think, you know, Roger McGuinn was the guitar player who played that Rickenbacker 12 string. It's he was the guitar player in the Birds. The Birds version of a Turn, 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 that whole intro there, that's all Rickenbacker 12 string. So that's that sort of chimey kind of sound. So it's rocking, but as Patrick said, it is kind of have like a folk tradition too. And yeah, there's some Beatles songs that have that Rickenbacker 12 string.
Yeah, they talk about that. The Rickenbacker was sent to John Lennon,
mm-hmm.
Who was not there that day. And so George got it.
Right.
And started playing it.
Well, with a 12 string electric is kind of interesting because when people play a 12 string acoustic, that sounds great whether you pick individual notes or if you strum. I feel like with the electric 12 strings, most of the parts that you may think of, it's all picked, like, you know, it's an arpeggio, it's like a chord, but they're usually not strumming a G chord, they're picking all the individual notes because you want each one of those strings to ring out. So for people who don't know guitar that well, what a 12 string is, so a regular guitar is 6 strings. A 12 string is what we call double courses, meaning it's not 12 separate, it does not give you 6 additional strings to play on. It's each normal string on the guitar is doubled up. And the lower pitch strings are actually an octave apart. So that's what really gives it that sound, is that it's like when you hit, so when you're hitting.
There's like a low and a high.
Yeah. On the lower strings. Once you get up to the G or the B, I'm not sure. Then it's just their unison. It's the same pitch because you can't have a higher, but the lower, like the E, the A and the D, they're an octave higher. They're thinner strings. And, that's what gives you that chiming sound, is that when you're plucking like let's say you're playing a G chord and you're playing that G note on the low E string. Well, when you pluck that note, now you're also getting an octave higher. So it's really everything really kind of jumps out and it sounds great.
Classical Gas, isn't that one that was played on a 12 string?
I thought that was a nylon string, but I could be wrong about that. I'm not as familiar with that. Do you know what Nashville tuning is, Patrick?
No.
Oh, it's good. We're going deep here, but this is on what Nashville tuning is. I think it was a trick that they used on a bunch of country recordings, Nashville recorded songs. I think they would usually do it with an acoustic guitar, but what they would do is they would take a set of 12, like a 12 string guitar set, but instead of putting all the strings on it, they would just put the higher pitched strings. So meaning you would have a regular 6 string guitar, but your low E, A, and D, instead of having its normal pitch, it had the super thin strings that were from the 12 string set. So when you'd strum it, you'd have no low end. It would be just like all high end. So you'd play it like a regular guitar, but it gave you this kind of like really kind of thinner, higher pitched texture. Now, you usually wouldn't hear a Nashville guitar played on its own. It would usually be like an overdub to kind of fill out the sound and fill out the higher range. So that was like a trick that recording studios did in Nashville. So I think like a lot of like country records have that kind of guitar somewhere in the background. So
interesting. I thought the Nashville tuning would be, this is the way you're going to tune it or else.
Maybe that's it too. You know, you're talking about, so I do want to watch Echo in the Canyon. Also on Netflix is the Bob Dylan, the Rolling Thunder review, kind of in the same vein. Did you watch
I tried to watch that. That's it's a little weird. Different. It's a little weirder. That's harder to get through. Yeah,
it is. I think ultimately it's worthwhile because, there are some really good music performances in it. All the in-between stuff, which is probably, if not half, maybe like a third of the movie is like all this behind the scenes stuff that was recorded in the 70s. And that stuff's, some of it's interesting, some of it's weird, some of it's kind of boring. but the actual performances are very good. And I'm not a big Dylan fan, but I think that's sort of peak Dylan. Like he sounds great. Like his voice sounds good. His guitar playing's good. And he had a really, really good band at that time too. He had like 4 guitar players in that band. It was T-Bone Burnett, who then later went on to do like a bunch of soundtrack music, like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou and all that. And Mick Ronson, who's most famous for playing with Bowie, he's in the band there. And so it's kind of a cool one to watch. But yeah, I agree. Weird. Hard to get through. One of my musician friends basically demanded that I watch it. So I kind of watched it for homework a little bit too. But worth watching. But I'm with you there. I had a little trouble getting going on it myself.
Sure. And the Echo in the Canyon one is kind of cool, but it feels like a very light documentary. Like I don't feel like it's, you know, it digs into the nitty gritty kind of 60s scene or anything like that. It's very focused on some very specific things, which is, and I believe it's like the music from 65 to 68. Like they were very specific in what they were looking at, and it's based on an anniversary of certain albums that came out of Laurel Canyon, which was it's an area in Hollywood, just off of Hollywood, where when you get in there, you feel like you are in the country. You're in the mountains. You're in a canyon. You're almost insulated from Hollywood and from that whole music scene. And you had a lot of the musicians of the time, like the Byrds, Crosby, Stills, Nash, Young, they were all up in there. You had the Beach Boys were there. You had the Mamas and the Papas. You name it, they were there. Buffalo Springfield. They were all in that area, along with a lot of other people. And it just became like this community where you could – go up the street, knock on somebody's door, and take your guitar, and suddenly, you know, you and Stephen Stills were writing songs together, kind of thing. It was that kind of environment. And it's just really interesting. Jacob Dylan did an album based on it. I don't think his voice is strong enough for a lot of those songs. He's very muted. He's very quiet. And I think he gets blown away by some of the people that he's singing with. That doesn't take away from the album itself. I still think it's a good album where he's covering a lot of these songs from the Byrds, from the Mamas and the Papas, the Beach Boys, so on and so forth. And I think he also did a concert film. Because they seem to show like little snippets of a concert that happened throughout the course of the documentary. I would like to see that concert film.
Yeah, that's cool. I am still into, I'm still listening to the Grateful Dead. I'm like in that phase and I'm still into it. And what you're talking about with this time-wise coincides, although the Dead was in San Francisco, although I think they did venture down to Los Angeles a little bit there. Was Crosby, Stills, and Nash in this doc at all? Because I think they were kind of, or their music at least.
They were, but not as Crosby, Stills, and Nash. So you had Crosby was part of the Byrds.
Right,
I believe.
He was, yeah.
Stills and Young were both part of Buffalo Springfield.
Right.
Nash was part of something. I don't remember what.
Yeah.
And they're all in this documentary. They're all talking about. Now Neil Young does not speak. There's only like some shots of him playing guitar. But you do have, David Crosby talking. You have Stephen Stills. You have Graham Nash. You have Michelle
Phillips.
Oh, Phillips, thank you, from the Mamas and the Papas. You have a lot of other people. You mentioned McGuire. He's in it.
McGuire.
I think
it was
McGuire.
Roger McGuinn is the guitar player from the Byrds.
Okay, then it is. Then it is him.
I think so. Anyway,
I thought it was McGuire, but we might be going back and forth.
Yeah.
You also have Brian Wilson.
Oh, sure.
Which was interesting that they got him in there to talk a little bit about some stuff. And Ringo Starr is big in it as well.
Was Wilson Phillips in it? The daughters?
They were not. No, they were not. That would have been great. Yeah, I love their music. So,
because they would have, because that's what there's. It's Michelle Phillips' daughter and Brian Wilson's kids. You're talking about like kind of knocking on doors. So when Crosby, Stills, and Nash become Crosby, Stills, and Nash, I think they make their way up to San Francisco, probably very soon after this period that movie covers. And they were sort of, neighbors to the Grateful Dead, and they influenced each other quite a bit too. Jerry Garcia is playing pedal steel on a couple of the Crosby, Stills, and Nash hits. And coincidentally, although David Crosby claims that he didn't really have that much of an influence on them, if you know anything about the Grateful Dead, their hits are all basically from two albums. One is American Beauty and one is Working Man's Dead. And it's the stuff that's like very folky, you know, like Friend of the Devil and Casey Jones and Truckin' and all that stuff. Because their first few albums were like really psychedelic and out there and, you know, not very song based, although there were songs there, but it's like lots of jamming and weird stuff. But their hits are all these kind of more folk country kinds of things. And those albums came when they were hanging out with David Crosby. And some of the, you know, they credit Crosby there, you know, so some of them do. They say like, yeah, well, you know, we were kind of hearing Crosby, Stills, and Nash sing, and we thought like, we should try to sing like that. We're not as good as they are singing wise, but why don't we try to just, instead of doing all this like psychedelic stuff, why don't we just try to make an album that's really good songs and really try to play them simply and sing three-part harmonies like Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And that's their hits are all those things from that period. Those albums are like 69 or 70, I think. So right after the period you're talking about, but right in there. But Crosby's like, no, they had it together before we were there. But I do think it's kind of funny that the time that they were hanging out at the time they made those albums.
One of my favorite lines in this entire documentary, Echo in the Canyon, comes from David Crosby. People are telling the story of kind of how the Birds imploded and ended up kicking him out. Mm-hmm. And then they cut to him and he's like, well, there's a story about why the Birds kicked me out. And I'm here to tell you right now, it's not true. The reason the Birds kicked me out was because I was an asshole. And I busted up laughing, you know? And he's like, I did not treat them well. And I was full of myself, which I thought was great. Just as a line, you know? It's interesting that you talk about his influence because they do talk about that quite a bit. And one of the lines from Michelle Phillips is that they were sitting there. She says, John and I were listening to the radio and a song came on and we said, wait a minute. That's the Birds. We know the Birds. Oh my God. If they can have a hit, anybody can have a hit. Which again was, you know, funny, but it's just that culture and community, they were all together in that one little moment in time and everybody was heavily influencing everybody else.
Cool. Yeah. That's really cool. I'm sorry.
I was going to say the flip side of that, since we're just going down the music road, you know, I continue to watch the country music documentary series with mom. I'm not like religiously watching it, but I just keep catching episodes every once in a while. Like, so there's a show that I like that came on CBS that's called Evil.
Okay.
Mom does not like it. Okay. There are certain things, like she does not like scary stuff. There are certain things that she does not like. This deals with an investigative team for the Catholic Church who are looking into things like demonic possession and that kind of stuff. She does not like the show at all. So when that comes on, I have to turn it and find something else for her to watch. And just happens this last week, that there was an episode of country music on PBS. So I flipped it to that and we watched that, and it was talking about, you talk about the Nashville tuning, you know, the Nashville sound versus there was a Dallas sound and there was a Bakersfield sound. Mm-hmm. You and I talked about that a little bit before we started recording. And, you had Willie Nelson coming out of Texas. But if you wanted to get a song recorded or a song published, you had to be in Nashville, really. Mm. And one of the things that struck me, and it's very similar to the Echo in the Canyon and the Laurel Canyon kind of stuff, is that there were a couple of places where people would go, and there was a bar that a lot of the country music people would go to, and that's where Willie Nelson would go. And you would basically, you know, drink and socialize with the country music stars, and then you'd sit down in a booth and you'd just kind of pitch them a song. And that's how, you know, he was sitting there one night and he had this song and he had a demo of it that he had recorded himself. And he got it played on the jukebox for Patsy Cline's husband. And he said, I want you to hear the song. And the husband said, wow, I think this would be a great song for Patsy. Let's go play it for her. And it's 2 o'clock in the morning. And he has to coax Willie Nelson to get in the car with him. And they drive over to the house. And Willie Nelson says, I'm not gonna wake up Patsy Cline at 2 o'clock in the morning. We're not doing this. And the husband said, oh, don't worry about it. And he gets up and he goes in and he wakes up Patsy Cline. And he says, there's a song you have to hear, but this guy won't come out of the car. And so Patsy goes out and says, come on, you know, I want you to come in. I want you to play this song for me. And she had to coax him out of the car, and they go into the house, and he plays this demo record that he had recorded for a song called Crazy.
Hmm.
Which he originally titled Stupid.
Okay.
But he played it for her and she said, I am so glad you woke me up. I'm putting this on my new album.
I had no idea that that's, I didn't know that Willie Nelson wrote that song. And yeah. I did not know that story at all.
Yeah. But the point was that there was this place. And, mm-hmm. and that's where a lot of people who had written music and was trying to get, you know, people's attention, they would go to this bar and they would meet the different people from the Nashville scene there and just socialize and talk and kind of build these relationships and pitch their songs, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah. I think it's important. I think communities are important. As I get older, I realize the value in that more and more. I think a lot of creative types and artistic types can tend to be kind of introverted and shy away from crowd or just like want to be by themselves. I know I get like that a lot. I think many of us do. But I think our overall well-being is dependent on communities. And I think specifically some sort of artistic community. Look, I think that's why we have done the show for 10 years because it's more of an online community, but it's a community and we have met some folks in real life. And I think that enriches your life being part of a community like that. I've talked a couple times about this musical community that I am a part of now locally in the town that I live in. And that's had a very positive effect on me musically, but also just my well-being, just being around other people, having some similar interests. And you know what it is? It's just kind of like being there, like not, you know, I think what we've probably seen sometimes like in our community is if you go into a community with some sort of agenda, I don't know, let's say like you're an up and coming author and you're really trying to spread the word about your book or get an agent or whatever. And if you focus too much on the business part of it, then you're really not getting as much out of it as you can be because, you know, it's just kind of being around the other people where the value comes from. And if, you know, things like success with your book happens too, that's great. But I noticed that people who are successful in that way within a community, it's usually because they've been around for a while and aren't pushy. They're present for other people. And I think if you're just kind of, you know, screaming buy my book, it's not a good way to be. But
we've talked about this before off air, you and I.
Yeah.
Not only the community, you know, surrounding the podcast. And I know for you it tends to be more online. Mm-hmm. A lot of times for me, I meet a lot of fans in person. Mm-hmm. I just posted the video with Cannoli Joe.
I saw that.
You know, Joe from Capricorn comes to town a couple of times a year. He has family here. His work sometimes brings him here. His wife's work sometimes brings her here. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I get to see him a couple of times a year when he's rolling through town. Sometimes I'll see him at Worldcon. So, you know, it was funny because we sat down for lunch and he immediately started talking about things that you and I have talked about on the podcast. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, it was really interesting that you guys were talking about this. Oh, I really enjoyed that you guys were talking about this. You know, it's the same thing at Mile High Con. There was, you know, several people there that I sat down and talked to who had very specific things about the podcast that they wanted to talk about. Beyond that, when you talk about the artist community, the writer community, our community, you and I talked about how I needed Mile High Con mm-hmm. in a big way. Like I just needed that. I needed to be there and talking to those folks. I needed to be around like-minded people and have those interactions. It recharges you.
Definitely.
It really does recharge you. And it definitely recharged me, you know, despite the physical medical things that I was going through at the time and other stuff as usual. But yeah, it's huge. I can't even describe how huge it is. And we talk about it in terms of community. A lot of other people talk about it now in terms of tribe.
Yeah. Same thing. Mm-hmm. Different name, same thing.
Yeah. Same concept.
Yeah. Well, I think when you're around, when you're in that kind of environment at a con or some kind of get together, what I often walk away from, a takeaway from something like that is sometimes when you're doing whatever your creative work is, I think overall as a society, we tend to look at those things, or some people tend to look at those things as being frivolous, as, oh, you write your little books or you play in your little band or it's kind of like, oh, that's your hobby. That's your thing. So sometimes when you can walk away, or you could just kind of walk around feeling that what you're doing doesn't have value, and you can get down about that. And when you're around at a Mile High Con, for instance, and you meet other people that are really passionate about what they're doing, it really is inspiring, because what it does is it validates what you're doing. Because it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have some sort of success in terms of selling a book or, you know, getting a deal or whatever. You just realize, no, it's valuable to be working on this craft. It's valuable for me as a human being. It's valuable to this community to be thinking about these ideas, to be discussing these ideas, to be working on writing my book or my short story or whatever it is. And that has been my experience with that, is I need to be around those communities, whether it's at a con or like this music community or whatever. I need to be around those people to kind of remind myself that leading a life of being creative or is important for itself, for its own right. It's not a frivolous hobby. And again, you don't have to have financial success or even a lot of fans or whatever. It's just the doing of it. It's important. And when you're around other people who do it for the love of doing it, it really feels good. I don't know if that's a similar thing that you felt when you go to like Mile High Con.
No, I think you're spot on, because it's the shared experiences, and it's you talk about, oh, well, you know, you're writing your little books, you're playing your little music. You know, that is exactly the reaction that I've gotten from family, you know, blood mm-hmm. family is what mm-hmm. the way I usually say it. Now there's blood family, and then there's everybody else that you choose to be your family. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, that the reaction I always get is, that's the space shit that you do. Mm-hmm. You know, like, you need to grow up. Mm-hmm. And then you go to a convention or a something where your community is there. And, you know, it's just like our last guest, Elle, you know, mentioned The Witcher, and she essentially squeed.
Right. Yeah.
And oh my God, The Witcher. I'm so excited about The Witcher too. It's like, yeah, it's that, right? It's right. That mm-hmm. right there. I go back to there was a round table. These are called fan round tables at Mile High Con. And it's in this little side room, and there are literally round tables set up, and there's just a topic, and there's a couple of people who play host. It's not really a moderated panel necessarily. And then just people are invited to come in and talk. And the particular one that I was in was the evolution of end credit scenes and Easter eggs. And only one person showed up other than myself and the other host, Chris Ward. And so Chris and I mean, we had a great conversation just talking about these things with that other person that was there. And I don't know where else you could do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where else are you going to sit down and say, let's talk about end scenes and you know, the Easter eggs in the end credit scene. Let's talk about those.
Yeah.
I think if you did that at work, people are going to be, what? Why?
I've heard it, you know, talk about tribes and communities. A long time ago, I heard this, you know, this kind of metaphor for like, you know, you're planting your flag for other people who value the same ideas and things, and hopefully other people can find you. I, you know, just this week when I was out watching this one band, I was talking to one of the guys that I've gotten to be pretty friendly with over the past few months, and I was telling him about another friend of mine, and I'm like, oh yeah, you know, because this community is based a lot around like the jam bands and the Grateful Dead and all that, but everybody likes all sorts of stuff, right? It's not just that. And I mentioned like, oh yeah, I played with this guy, you know, he was in this jam band, but he really loved this band Jellyfish, who I loved too. And we really had this bonding moment over this obscure band Jellyfish, who we both really loved their two albums, and it was so meaningful to us. So I'm telling this one guy about it, and he's like, I love Jellyfish too. Like, and then so he and I then bonded over this obscure band that had these like two kind of obscure albums. And that feels so good. You don't, you know, I know it sounds cheesy, but you don't feel so alone in the world. Sometimes,
right.
You end up just sort of being like, well, I like this stuff, but nobody else does. So, you
know. So that was a good talk.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So. Now, on Tuesday, The Mandalorian dropped on Disney Plus. We haven't talked about that yet, John. What did you think about that show?
Patrick's punking all you, as you people know. We record the. I was thinking about that. So when this episode airs, I think two episodes will have already aired, with a third on the way. Because I think the release schedule is there will be the first episode of The Mandalorian will be available at launch, which is November 12th. I think they're putting another one out that Friday. So I think they're going to be two episodes within the first week, and then maybe another one on the day that I'm not sure exactly, but there will be at least two episodes out by the time this airs, which we haven't seen either of them yet. But I'm sure if I can like interject, like I'm sure I would have a lot to say about it. Look, I'm excited about it. I'm excited because all the trailers and stuff I've seen look good. It's a time period that the newer books really haven't explored. Look, Luke and Han are not showing up in this. You know, like, I think everybody knows that or would hope to. But as I've said, I think episode one is a Filoni directed episode too. Dave Filoni, for people who don't know, who did the Clone Wars and all the animated stuff. You know, having Filoni there, I mean, look, I'm high on it anyway, but the fact that Filoni seems very involved, like maybe, I know it's Favreau, but I think Filoni is Favreau's right-hand man in this. And I don't know if you're going to see call-outs, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's better connections with this series to existing Star Wars properties than you've seen in recent movies. But who knows? It's something that's good. I don't care. It doesn't have to have those connections. But I wouldn't be surprised if you see some callbacks to Clone Wars or Rebels or something. But I'm excited. I think it's – and look, they put a lot of money into it. Do you know what the budgets are? It's a lot, right? It's like – it's Game of Thrones level money, I think, if I'm not – or more. I don't know. I'm excited.
I did see something. I don't remember where. It may have been – may have been on the patrons thing where they were talking about this is you know, based on the trailer, there's nothing in here you wouldn't see in a movie.
No, it looks like a
movie.
As
far as effects and cinematography and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So it should be very interesting.
I think, you know, and I'm echoing things I've heard on other Star Wars podcasts and reading the blogs. And I think you posted to the Facebook page, and I know you want to wrap it up so that's we don't have to do another half hour on Star Wars, but you posted an article about, you know, them taking like a little hiatus.
Yeah. Hiatus on the movies after Rise of Skywalker.
And I've heard that for a while. That's been sort of in the air for a while. And not surprised. I think it's actually kind of necessary. And obviously they're focusing on the TV shows on Disney Plus. Now we'll see. We may be three episodes into The Mandalorian and we may think it's crap. I think Star Wars is going to be well suited to television. It's such a large universe. I think having the time, instead of having a 2.5 hour movie, to have a 10 hour series to explore the world and the characters and, you know, just the Mandalorian itself, it's going to be a smaller story, and that's going to really fit TV, I think. So we'll see, but I for one am happy to see them focusing their attention on the TV shows, and there'll be movies soon enough. I know Solo didn't end up making, you know, as much as they're used to, but those movies will make a ton and continue to. So I think they'll focus on TV for a while. I'm sure they got a lot of other movies kind of, although, you know, it looks like Benioff and Weiss are out. I've been hearing rumblings that the Rian Johnson trilogy is dead now too.
That was the article I posted.
Yeah. So it's, you know, that's not surprising. You know, reboot it or not reboot it, but just like, you know, get a fresh start on it all. Have a bit more of a plan. I know Feige is going to be doing a movie, you know.
I think it comes down to exactly what you just said. I think it comes down to Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah.
They said the Cylons had a plan. They were full of shit.
Yeah.
They never had a plan. They were winging it as they went. And then when it came time to actually have the plan, they kind of blew it.
Yeah.
And I feel like they did not really have a plan.
No.
I don't think JJ really had a plan.
No.
He just, you know, he got the toys that he wanted to play with, and in very Stephen Moffat fashion, you know, decided to play with the toys the way he was going to play with the toys, and now they're having to kind of roll back a little bit and say, huh, yeah, we need to do something different. Same thing is kind of happening with DC.
Mm.
And there's been a lot of stories, you know, about the fact that HBO Max is coming.
Right.
And there's going to be some DC content on HBO Max. The whole HBO Max thing to me is interesting because it's going to actually – they're keeping the other HBO streaming stuff.
Right.
But then they're going to have HBO Max. And HBO Max is also going to have things like – was it Friends?
I think it's I think you're right. Yeah.
And Doctor Who,
weird,
moving forward, is going to be on HBO Max. Like, they're getting different kinds of content over there that isn't HBO specific.
Yeah.
DC and Warner Brothers, because Warner Brothers owns HBO.
Right.
I think
okay.
is how it goes.
Okay.
So they're going to move, you know, they're going to do the anthology series and the Green Lantern thing, I think, are both going
there.
Oh,
right. The Berlanti's doing the Green Lantern thing, right? That's cool.
So that's going over there, but they're still keeping DC Universe. So Titans and Doom Patrol and Harley Quinn and Young Justice, those things I think are staying on DC Universe for
okay.
now.
I feel like the HBO Max thing is kind of a branding mess right now in terms of like, well, what is going to be over there and what kind of – but look, I have no plans to get that. But if there's enough good stuff on there, I'll do what I always do. I'll sign up for a month and watch what I want on there. Because I know HBO's got some pretty good stuff. I know they got like the Watchmen thing going on and the Dark Materials thing. So there's some interesting things on HBO now, but I'm not doing HBO right now.
And everything that HBO has ever done, original series, is going to be on HBO Max.
Well, that's – so if you have that plus
– So The Wire – The Sopranos, True Blood, Game of Thrones, all that stuff is going to be on HBO Max. Deadwood.
You know what's funny is I'm sure it'll go away, but right now most of the older HBO stuff is on Amazon. You can watch on Prime. Yep. But I bet that will go away once. I bet they're just waiting out the clock on that they probably signed a deal with Amazon a couple of years ago.
But I did just read as well that Disney made a deal with Prime so that their Disney Plus app will appear on like the Fire TV Sticks and all that kind of stuff. There will also be a Disney Plus app on your game console. So like your PS4 will have an app so you can stream your stuff straight to PS4.
Did you see the thing about the Stars ad on Disney Plus? Did you see that?
Kind of, sort of, yeah.
Yeah, it's just basically, I don't think it's going to be a recurring ad. Just maybe like the first time you sign into the Disney Plus,
they're going to run a Stars. Yeah.
Well, because I think they want the Star Wars movies back that Stars had the rights to. So I guess part of the deal is like, all right, we'll give it back to you early, but you got to run an ad for us. So I think that's part of the deal. So that's sort of funny, but that's where they're at with it.
Hey, you know, they're trying to be really aggressive. The stuff that I read said that they're shooting for 60 million subscribers.
For Disney Plus, yeah.
For Disney Plus.
Well, look, just the price alone, because you know they're going to be operating in terms of that one service. That's not what that service is going to be worth. They're just trying to make it as low as possible to get as many people to sign up.
They're keeping the bundle price slightly below Netflix highest price.
Yeah.
So the bundle price that gets you Disney Plus, ESPN, and Hulu with ads,
right?
So it is Hulu with ads.
Yeah,
I wouldn't know it will be, that. I think, a dollar cheaper than Netflix's most expensive tier.
Right, right. And that ESPN Plus, I think, is a pretty limited streaming thing. Like, I don't even know if you're going to get all of the ESPN content. You know, it's just some stuff. But hey, if it suits what you want, go for it. But yeah, I wouldn't go back to Hulu with ads. No way. So I'll just pay for Disney Plus on its own. But that's the plan. But I guess the next time we speak, I'll at least have seen some episodes of The Mandalorian. I don't know where you're going to be with that, if you're going to break down and get it anyway. But we'll see. You like Star Wars, so I wouldn't be surprised if you broke down and got it. So we'll see. Or maybe you'll just wait until all the episodes are up there and then do it that way. So
I don't know. I also think it is curious that they're continuing the network model of an episode a week.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another whole conversation. I prefer to binge myself, and I think a lot of people do, but in a lot of ways, it makes sense to put them out an episode a week. It's like, look, you put it out an episode a week, you know, especially with like Star Wars, all the sites are going to write up, you know, reviews of the episode. Like, so why dump all your episodes in a weekend? It hits the news cycle for 1 week, whereas you could stretch it out over 10 weeks and you can have all the sites write you up every week.
Yeah.
And normally I would wait till it all just hits, but it's Star Wars. I'm not going to be able to wait till all the episodes
and that's exactly what's happening with Titans and Young Justice.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to be very careful. There's a ton of articles and spoilers about Titans and a ton of them about Young Justice because those episodes drop every week.
Right.
So that's been very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not particularly that interested in Doom Patrol, even though I've heard that it's a really good series.
Mm.
I watched the episode of Titans where they introduced Doom Patrol, and then that was it, you know? So that's interesting to me. You mentioned, I know we're running long now.
That's
you
okay.
mentioned Jack Ryan. I did actually stream the entire Jack Ryan series. I binged it.
Cool.
As soon as I saw you post that they had dropped it early,
mm-hmm.
I was sick at the time. So yeah. I was able to watch those episodes.
Cool.
And I do have thoughts about that. We need to talk about that at some point.
I have I have two more episodes left. So it's actually perfect timing because it's, this will keep me busy until The Mandalorian, and then I'll just get right into that. So by the time the next time we talk, I'll have finished Jack Ryan and watched whatever The Mandalorian is there. So we'll have plenty to talk about next time in terms of that. So
and then I continue to say Arrow is blowing it out of the water, man. Oh, my God. It's such a good season.
That. Yeah.
Oh, such a good season so far. That. And I mean, they just jumped right into Crisis. They just jumped into it. So here's an interesting thing for folks. Batwoman and Supergirl are not really doing anything crisis related.
Okay.
so far this season. Mm-hmm. Flash has been crisis heavy. Arrow is 100% crisis. You know, he's out there doing stuff, and it's all crisis. Legends has not come back yet.
Okay.
And then I don't think Black Lightning is doing anything crisis related. They're still standalone-ish.
Cool. Patrick, I feel like that was the most us episode we've ever done. I think we hit like everything that is of interest to us. We talked about music, we talked about cons, we talked about creativity, we talked about community, we talked about streaming, we talked about Star Wars, we talked about, I think we hit everything. So there you go. All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. Patrick and I really appreciate it. As we always mention, there's the patreon.com/functionalnerds. Patrick posts a lot there. I've been trying to post a little more, although I've been a little light the last week or two, but I'm trying to.
Yeah, stuff you've been posting is awesome.
Well, it's thanks. I try to keep up with it. It's been a little bit of a hectic couple weeks here, so I haven't been doing as much as I was, but I'm trying to post stuff there. And Patrick posts a lot, and the patrons that are already there, they post stuff, they get in on the cut. So if you like this kind of community that we've been talking about, just go over to patreon.com/functionalnerds, support us for like $1 a month. You can get access to that patron only Facebook group, and it's a lot of fun, and you won't feel so alone if you go over there. So yeah, consider doing that. But that's that. So Patrick, anything else you want to leave our listeners with before we wrap it up today?
Oh my God, we've talked about so much stuff. I don't know. I don't know, man. This was a great episode. I enjoyed this episode quite a bit.
I agree. Thank you. So everyone, have a great week. We'll see you next time, and have a good one.
Smoke. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
'You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.